Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we welcome back to the program Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of the best-selling book, Darwin's Doubt, darwinsdoubt.com for more information. And I want to focus with you, Dr. Meyer. Welcome back to the program. It's so great to have you on again.
Absolutely. It's always good to be with you, Jerry.
Sure. And I want to focus on the issue of the fossil record and evolution. I read recently a critique of a Christian school where this person writing a critique of the school was faulting it for what it did or didn't say about the fossil record, and they were faulting one of the books that were used. And here's a quote from this person on his way to becoming a paleontologist in the secular mindset. He said, "They," meaning the Christian school and the textbook, "they say that fossils are found out of order in the way evolution says they should be found. This, however, is a complete lie, and talking to any real paleontologist would explain why this is completely false." Let me stop right there and just have you unpack that sentence.
Well, actually, the fossils in some of the best examples of alleged transitions from one major group to another are often found out of order. And one of the best known alleged transitions is the so-called reptile to mammal transition, and the intermediates are alleged to be mammal-like reptiles. And in our textbook, Explore Evolution, we have a extensive discussion of this, and we show that there are a number of what are called stratigraphic anomalies. They line the bones up to make it look like the skulls get gradually larger and more mammal-like over time, but the skulls that are aligned in that way are actually found at different layers, so that the correct temporal sequence doesn't go smaller, slightly bigger, slightly bigger, slightly bigger, and slightly more mammal-like. It actually is all out of order. And so you have big skulls before little skulls, and then big ones reappear, and then little ones are in the sequence later. So if you line them up in a correct temporal sequence, it doesn't look like the same smooth transition at all. Moreover, the bones that have been found for this, which is thought to be one of the best examples of a transitional sequence in the fossil record, the bones of these different creatures have been found all over the globe. So when you look at the presentation of the evidence in the textbook, it looks as if, oh, they must have been all in a sequence stacked up upon each other in the sedimentary record, all in the same place. But they're found from all over the globe, so you really have to rearrange things both temporally and spatially to get that nice, smooth sequence.
I know when it comes to human evolution, when you see the timeline and they show the stooped-over ape-like creature, and then that evolves slowly, and then finally at the end you have man walking. When it comes to the different fossils and so forth, you just don't have that same kind of thing in the actual fossil record, do you?
Well, even before we talk about the human evolution or the hominid sequence, as it's alleged, it might be helpful just to talk about the pattern of the fossil record generally, because
sure.
I think it's important to put the whole discussion in context. In the 1970s, there was a new theory of evolution proposed called punctuated equilibrium, and it was proposed by Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge. Gould has since died. Eldridge is still very much with us. And their concern was that they were having to shoehorn the fossils into this smooth, continuous, great branching tree pattern that was part of Darwin's original theory of evolution, and the part of his theory which sought to depict the history of life. So the idea was that you had the first simple organism represented by the trunk of the tree, and then all of the branches as they spread out from that trunk represented the new forms of life that would have gradually arisen, morphed and changed as a result of the slow acting process of natural selection acting on random variations, and later we would talk about mutations. So this tree of life suggested that all forms of life that exist today, though they be quite different from each other, are all descended from the same common ancestor through a process of descent with modification. Now, the actual fossil record does not reinforce this pattern at all. It doesn't support this pattern. What we see instead are major groups of organisms coming abruptly into the sedimentary record, persisting for a time without changing much. Sometimes there's some variation within limits. And then either persisting all the way to the present or going extinct. And so in the 1970s, Eldridge and Gould decided that in order to represent the fossil record more accurately, they needed to come up with a new theory of evolution that did not try to insist on this model of gradual change one thing from another. And their model they called punctuated equilibrium. Punctuation represented the sudden or abrupt appearance of new forms of life, and then the equilibrium, or what they also called stasis, represented the other thing that we saw in the fossil record, which was long periods in which the major groups of organisms did not change or did not change much. And so their theory was a much better representation of what we see in the fossil record. They were both paleontologists, and they were tired of having evolutionary orthodoxy force them to shoehorn their depiction of the fossil record into a pattern, a tree-like pattern, that they did not actually see in the record. And so this has been a kind of an interesting development, because it's highlighted what paleontologists have long known, which is that the fossil record shows discontinuity, not continuous change.
Well, if I could ask just real briefly, and I'll get right back to the critic's letter, what is your opinion of punctuated equilibrium as a scientist, as one who earned his PhD at Cambridge University in the study of science?
Well, my PhD was in the philosophy of science, but I worked on the question of biological origins. So this was what I've been focusing on for the last 30 years.
Oh, okay.
And the Darwin's Doubt is a book about the doubt that Darwin had about the adequacy of his own theory with respect to the fossil record. He knew of a major event in the history of life that we now call the Cambrian explosion, which was a classic example of a huge punctuation, abrupt appearance of, in fact, not just one, but we now know of about three dozen major animal body plans that first arose. The first animals all arose in the Cambrian period, almost all arose in the Cambrian period. And Darwin was troubled by this, and my book, Darwin's Doubt, tells the story of his doubt and what's become of it. Part of what became of it was Eldridge and Gould. They picked up this, they finally formulated a new non-Darwinian theory of evolution in the 1970s and 80s that tried to account for the fossil record more accurately. Long story short, what happened to their theory is that by the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, most evolutionary biologists had rejected it, not because it wasn't an accurate depiction of the fossil record, but because Gould and Eldridge were unable to come up with any mechanism that could generate biological change that quickly. And in the end, they had to, the best they could come up with was kind of reaffirming a version of natural selection acting on random mutations, which is a very slow-acting mechanism and would not have produced the kind of abrupt appearance and pattern that we see in the fossil record. So it was a good description of the fossil record, but it was a bad theory of evolution, and it's pretty much been rejected in the establishment. I write about this in, I think it's the sixth or seventh chapter of Darwin's Doubt, and tell the story of the rise and fall of this very interesting idea.
All right, so let me continue now with this critic of the Christian school. He said this: we do not find higher evolved animals with lower evolved animals, for instance. We do not find humans with dinosaurs, smilodons, and trilobites. We do not find mastodons with tiktaalik and apes in Precambrian rock layers. I'll stop right there and have you pontificate.
Some of that's all true and well and good. All he's talking about is that there is a progression, a general progression, that we see in the fossil record from some forms of life that don't exist anymore to forms of life that do. Generally, people have said that there's an increasing level of complexity in these organisms. I think there are some dissenting voices about that, because we now know that even single cells are amazingly complex. And you have, for example, in the Cambrian, On the standard dating scale, 530 million years ago, you have arthropods and fish and echinoderms and many of the groups that we have today on the planet first arising. I have a fossil, about 5 feet away from me on my shelf of a trilobite that was so well preserved that its eyes are visible very clearly, and you can see the cones in the compound eye. It has a compound eye, much the same type of eye that insects have today. The phylum arthropod includes both these ancient trilobites and modern insects and crabs, and it's an extraordinarily complex visual apparatus that was present from the dawn of animal life. So generally speaking, I think people are happy to say they see a progression in the fossil record from simple to complex, but there really is no simple life, and there's very complex forms right from the very beginning. Of course, we humans may well be the most complex thing that has been created, but we're at the very end. So, you know, there's some sense to saying that, but to say that things have progressed is not the same thing as that one thing in the past caused another thing. And that's a logical fallacy called post hoc ergo propter hoc. Before this, therefore the cause of that. Not so. And what we see in the fossil record with these huge discontinuous and abrupt emergences of these different forms of life is not something that would lead us to think that the forms in the past were necessarily the cause of the forms in the future. There's a discontinuity, not continuity. So there's two separable issues. One is, how do we best describe this progression of forms that we see arising in the fossil record? And secondly, does the pattern that we see actually support the idea that an undirected mechanism like natural selection and random mutation produced that pattern? There is a progression of forms that we see, but the progression and the pattern of appearance, I don't think supports either universal common descent or the idea that natural selection and random mutation are the cause of the pattern that we do see.
All right, and then last question. Here's another statement from this critic of the Christian school. They also completely gloss over the fact that we have hundreds of thousands of transitional forms or fossils, and they do not teach evolution with biology, even though evolution is one of the foundational parts of biology. You have basically 2 minutes to critique that.
Right. Well, on the second point first, we've always suggested that it's important to teach the theory of evolution, but also to teach the scientific criticisms of the theory as they appear in the scientific literature. And we have a textbook that we've generated to do just that. It's called Explore Evolution. And many Christian schools, as well as secular schools, are using it as a supplement to the mainstream biology textbooks, which do not inform students about any of the problems with evolutionary theory.
Yeah, and they still use outmoded things that have been proven false,
like embryos,
peppered moths, and
like,
so
forth. Yeah, still make it in. But as to the number of transitional forms, I think that's grossly exaggerated. There are a few sequences that are often offered, like the horse sequence, perhaps the whale sequence, and the mammal-like reptiles. The overwhelming pattern in the fossil record is, as Gould and Eldred stated, it's punctuation, sudden appearance, and stasis, long periods of non-unidirectional change. I think your critic needs to get more informed about the big picture in paleontology. And as I mentioned, even some of the classic examples of transitionals have a number of problems with them that I think justify some skepticism. So I'm on board with the horse sequence, perhaps, but mammal-like reptiles I'm very doubtful about. And I'm doubtful now about the whale sequence as well. There's some anomalies there that have been glossed over. So I think the big picture, though, is at the higher taxonomic levels, where you see the big changes arising in the history of life, there's clear discontinuity. There might be evidence of common ancestry within groups at the lower taxonomic levels.
Well, I think this critic and everybody would do well to read your book, Darwin's Doubt. DarwinsDoubt.com for more information. Dr. Stephen Meyer, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us on Focal Point.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry, and for your interest in all this geeky science stuff. It's been fun to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good to talk with you, too. Thank you. God bless. All right, bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
You, too.